We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Away we go, episode 799 of the Al Galdi podcast. It is Friday, April 5th, 2024, the day after the Kansas City Chiefs, yes, the mighty Chiefs, officially announced the signing of an unrestricted free agent quarterback. He is a former Commanders quarterback. He is Carson Wentz. Now, he will always be Commander Carson to us, but he now is on his second team since being with our team for the 2022 season. The Chiefs, in fact, are Carson's fifth team in five seasons. 2020, the Philadelphia Eagles. 2021, the Indianapolis Colts. So 2022, the Washington Commanders. 2023, the Los Angeles Rams. And now 2024, the Kansas City Chiefs. I'll say this for Carson. Two of the best head coaches in the NFL and two of the smartest offensive coaches in the NFL, the Rams, Sean McVay, and the Chiefs, Andy Reid, have thought enough of Carson to have him since his time with the Commanders. So as poorly as his season with our team ultimately went, it says something that McVay and Reid have wanted Carson. So good for him. Good for Commander Carson. Hello and welcome to this Friday installment of the Al Galdi podcast. Also on Thursday was another Commanders free agent defection. Commanders unrestricted free agent linebacker Khalique Hudson has agreed on a contract with the New Orleans Saints, who already this offseason had signed San Francisco 49ers unrestricted free agent edge defender Chase Young, who of course was taken by the Redskins with the number 2 overall pick in the 2020 NFL draft. The Skins took Hudson in the fifth round of the 2020 draft, took him with the pick acquired from the Seattle Seahawks in the trade of corner Quentin Dunbar. Remember him. But bottom line, the Saints now are set to have two members of Washington's 2020 draft class, whereas Washington has zero members of its 2020 draft class. Yes, not a single player from our team's 2020 draft class is still on the team. Hopefully, our team's 2024 draft class will be a bit better than that 2020 draft class. What almost certainly will define the Commanders' 2024 draft class is what they do with their number 2 overall pick in the draft. Which quarterback should they take with that pick, or with a pick acquired via that pick, because they, of course, could trade down? Well, as the great debate of North Carolina quarterback Drake May versus LSU quarterback Jaden Daniels versus Michigan quarterback J.J. McCarthy rages on, I next segment am going to welcome to the show a guest with a really interesting perspective, NFL draft analyst Ian Cummings of Pro Football Network. He has Drake May as the QB1 in the 2024 draft. Yes, the QB1, as in the number one quarterback in the draft, as in ahead of the consensus QB1 in the draft, USC's Caleb Williams. And as you'll hear with Ian, he's not some loudmouth hot take spewing gas bag, okay? No, he puts in a lot of work in studying draft prospects, and he has a very intellectual, reasoned, measured outlook on the quarterbacks in the 2024 draft. And by the way, Ian likes Caleb Williams and Jaden Daniels quite a bit. Ian just likes Drake May the most. Also, we with Ian are going to spend some time discussing Washington quarterback Michael Penix Jr. and Oregon quarterback Bo Nix. Two quarterbacks who we have not spent much time discussing, but two quarterbacks who we should discuss as we with this Commanders quarterback decision shall leave no stone unturned. In-depth, high IQ, NFL draft quarterback talk, next segment with NFL draft analyst Ian Cummings of Pro Football Network. By the way, picking up a lot of steam in recent days has been what ESPN NFL insider Adam Schefter recently said. Adam Schefter, of course, perhaps the number one NFL insider on the planet. Adam Schefter, the person who in the days leading up to the Commanders hiring Dallas Cowboys defensive coordinator Dan Quinn as head coach told us that Detroit Lions offensive coordinator Ben Johnson was not the presumptive favorite to be the Commanders' next head coach. Schefter said this loudly and more clearly than anyone else did. I give him credit for that. Well, this was Schefter on his podcast, the Adam Schefter podcast. This is from the episode that came out this past Monday.
I know we're not supposed to spoil picks. We'll see how the Commanders decide to move forward with the number two overall selection. But a little over a few weeks out, to me, I think the signs continue to point to Jaden Daniels being the second overall pick at number two. Seems like he's popular in the scouting community. Seems like he would bring a lot of the attributes that the Commanders would like. I think Jaden Daniels would have a high level of interest in the Las Vegas Raiders, and the Las Vegas Raiders would have a high level of interest in Jaden Daniels. But there's one problem. The Commanders have the second pick. And I think Jaden Daniels is going to be somebody that really appeals to them, as he would a lot of teams, as talented as he is. And it's hard for me today, to see Jaden Daniels sliding much past pick number two. So let's pencil him in there. And I know we're not supposed to reveal the picks in advance. We don't know what the picks will be.
Right.
But again, we'll see how the shakes out. I think that's how it's stacking up a few weeks out. Caleb Williams one, Jaden Daniels two.
All right, make of that what you will, but Adam Schefter, the man who called the Commanders not hiring Ben Johnson as head coach, now is calling for the Commanders to take Jaden Daniels with the number two overall pick in the 2024 draft. Also on the show, I'll review a bad Thursday for Washington, D.C. versus Pittsburgh. The Capitals, they on Thursday night lost to the Pittsburgh Penguins 4-1 in a big game at Capital One Arena. The Caps in their push for the Stanley Cup playoffs are fading. The Caps now are 0-3-1 over their last four games. And the Nationals, they on Thursday lost to the Pittsburgh Pirates 7-4 at Nationals Park as starting pitcher Josiah Gray got roughed up for a second time in as many starts in this young MLB season. You can hit me up on X at Al Galdi. You can email me, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. Email from Dr. CCB on our recent conversations about a new nickname for the Commanders due to them having so many coaches and players from the Dallas Cowboys. We got a recent email from Billy D in NC. He, among other suggestions, suggested Cowanders, which, yes, does give preference to Cowboys over Commanders, but I found Cowanders funnier than another suggestion, Cowboys. Anyway, writes Dr. CCB, hope all is well. I was thinking about the nickname for those players who migrated over from Dallas. We can't call them Cowanders because it gives preference to the Cowboys. Maybe we could call them Command Boys. Just a thought. Thank you for the email, Dr. CCB, Command Boys. That's not bad, and it is the same amount of syllables as Cowanders, although I still find Cowanders to be funny. Email from the great Howard Gutman. the former United States ambassador to Belgium and a good friend of and strategic advisor for Mitchell Rales, who is the top limited partner in the Commanders ownership group, the Josh Harris Group. The ambassador, a loyal listener of and a multi-time guest on this podcast. And he writes regarding the passing of Larry Lucchino, who died on Tuesday. He was 78. Larry Lucchino, a major executive with both the Orioles and the Redskins. He worked for Williams & Connolly, which was the law firm founded by Edward Bennett Williams, who owned the O's and was part owner of the Skins. Lucchino was with the O's from August 1979 through October 1993, including being their president and chief executive officer from August 1988 through October 1993. Larry Lucchino played a massive role in the building of Oriole Park at Camden Yards, which opened beginning with the 1992 season and forever changed stadiums in MLB. Camden Yards set the trend for these modern MLB ballparks that are so good. And Lucchino was a member of the Redskins Board of Directors from 1979 to 1985. Writes Ambassador Gutman, "I am literally sitting right now in a big waiting room waiting to see if I will be called for jury duty. And I am still swamped by the sadness of losing my friend, former law partner, and once mentor, Larry Lucchino. And so I figured that writing to you and the show and explaining and thereby sharing a glimpse of Larry's magic could only help me. Call it Galdi Show Therapy. I have long mocked the idea of mentors and mentoring, as I have long thought that people mentor their own way. But indeed, with Larry's death, I realized how much of an influence on me, my life, who I am, and how I act, Larry represented. He was anything but sweet, and he did not tolerate fools easily, but yet he had such a huge heart and so cared about others that I suspect that literally thousands of people sincerely feel and will tell you that Larry had a special place in his heart for them, and thus they did as well for Larry. When my then newborn son and now co-host of the Commanders postgame gut check on 910 The Fan, Colin, in 1988 was struggling for his life at Georgetown Hospital at 2 pounds, 7 ounces, Larry was struggling there for his own life, suffering with lymphoma. Each time Larry came for his chemo infusions, we visited the neonatal intensive care unit together. Larry, therefore, rooted for Colin his entire life, making Colin an Oriole clubhouse attendant when Colin was at Whitman High School and a Red Sox summer intern while Colin was at Yale. By flashing one smile at your kid, Larry could create joy for father and son. In our first conversation 42 years ago, as I, a brand new associate at the firm, came to meet this respected Williams & Connolly partner for an assignment, I offered a suggestion or insight. Without missing a beat and with a wide-grinned chuckle, Larry responded that I should trade it in for a horse and shoot the horse. I have used that line probably hundreds of times in the past 42 years. He was fiercely competitive and a fighter, but with great judgment. When new draftee Ben McDonald made outrageous signing demands, I reflexively urged Larry to F him. Larry reminded me both that it was never personal and also never to F someone when you actually would be effing yourself. He was indeed a true fighter, so I am sure he went with spirits high, but he took a piece of so many with him." Thank you for the email, Ambassador Gutman. What a great email. You know, I've actually spent a good bit of time these last few days researching and reading about Larry Lucchino, because he was mostly before my time, but he had such a unique impact in having been a major executive with two prominent teams in the Washington, D.C. area, the Skins and the O's. And he was with those teams during very meaningful times. He was with the Skins when they won the Super Bowl for the 1982 season and won the NFC Championship for the 1983 season. And he was with the O's when they won the 1983 World Series. Man, you think about D.C. area sports from, say, 1982 through 1985. You had the Skins winning the Super Bowl for the 1982 season and winning the NFC Championship for the 1983 season. You had the O's winning the 1983 World Series. You had Georgetown basketball making the national championship game, not just the Final Four, the national championship game in 3 out of 4 years, 1982, 1984, and 1985, including winning the national title in 1984. You had Maryland basketball with Len Bias. You had Navy basketball with David Robinson. You had Maryland football having great success with Bobby Ross as head coach. You had the Capitals beginning their time as regular participants in the Stanley Cup playoffs. You had the Bullets as regular participants in the NBA playoffs. Seriously, has there ever been a better time in Washington, D.C. area sports than 1982 through 1985, or thereabouts? I mean, we can quibble with the years, but you get the idea. The early and mid-1980s, a truly special time in Washington, D.C. area sports.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy, with Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketplace platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. It's okay if you don't know much about marketing. Constant Contact's writing assistant tools and automation features help you craft messaging and say the right things at the right time. I use this to help write and send my email newsletters, and you should too. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
If you happen to be listening to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, you can write a review of the podcast saying that you like it. The review can be just a sentence or two, but the reviews help out the podcast a lot. Thank you for doing them. One of the more interesting items about the Commanders' quarterback decision via their number 2 overall pick in the 2024 NFL Draft has been how so many NFL Draft analysts view North Carolina quarterback Drake May versus LSU quarterback Jaden Daniels, and how the betting market views May versus Daniels. For weeks, there was a decent-sized gap between the two views, with the consensus of analysts being May over Daniels, but the betting market consensus having Daniels as a sizable favorite over May to be taken by the Commanders at 2. And while opinions on May versus Daniels continue to be all over the place, we this week at some sports books have seen May as the favorite over Daniels to be taken by the Commanders at 2. Now, something that has been consistently clear is that USC quarterback Caleb Williams is the consensus at QB1 in the 2024 draft, but I am very pleased to welcome to the Al Galdi podcast right now an NFL draft analyst who has Drake May not just ahead of Jaden Daniels, but ahead of Caleb Williams. NFL draft analyst Ian Cummings of Pro Football Network. You can follow him on X at IC_draft. Hey, Ian, how are you?
I'm good. You know, we have under a month to go before the NFL draft. Still a lot of time to talk about these guys and have arguments about which QB is the best one, right? You know, no one knows what's going to happen. And I think that's the most enjoyable part about this, right? There's so many different outcomes, so many different teams that could be in a conversation for a certain guy. So until then, all we can do is pour through those outcomes and just kind of imagine what's going to happen. But we're kind of, our hands are tied. You know, we're just kind of waiting to see what goes on.
Yes, we are, especially with the Commanders. General Manager Adam Peters is playing things rather close to the vest. So let's establish this. Your top four quarterbacks in the 2024 draft are who?
Yeah, so Drake May is actually in the highest tier in this class for me. It's May and Caleb Williams is 1A, 1B on my board. I'm a big fan of May. I have been since 2022. I think for his profile, right, there is a little more situational imprecision in adverse situations. Again, I do think the accuracy can be a little better, some slight mechanical things to work on. I think mainly his base width. But to me, he has probably one of the best, if not the best, combination of physical talent and operational utility in this class. At 6'4", 230, he's incredible athlete. You know, he's got very good speed and explosiveness in space, but he can also make guys miss, sidestep in the pocket, expand plays outside the pocket in the flats, and he can throw off platform too. He's very natural off platform. He's got great arm elasticity and angle freedom, and his arm strength is really impressive. I think his ability, again, to put the ball in a line, throw it to where only his receivers can get it, but then also kind of weaponize that with eye manipulation and DB, you know, anticipation, right? I think those are big things with him. I think it's one thing that, you know, he doesn't always show because, again, the mechanics can be a little inconsistent, but you can tell he has it up here in his mind, right? You can tell he's seeing the right windows. He's able to control the field at will with his eyes and open windows for himself and then capitalize. So big fan of what he has to offer in that range. So it's him and Williams at the top. Jaden Daniels is my QB3. His arm isn't quite as strong as Mayer Williams, and that kind of dilutes his upside for me a little bit. Also not quite as elastic, but as an athlete, as a mover, the dude is electric. You know, he's got speed, explosiveness more than anyone in the class. You know, he can hit really impressive amounts of speed in open space, and he can evade guys too, but also his deep passing ability, his trajectory, IQ, his ability to loft passes to where only his receiver can get it, the accuracy and the deep range. It's really impressive to me. And then he's a tough competitor as well. JJ McCarthy right now is my QB4. I think with him, you know, it's a big projection issue. What can he be versus what he is now? There was a lot of talk about him not elevating that Michigan offense, but at the same time, I do think for such a young QB, just 21 years old, we do have to give him credit for what he does well. He's very good at managing the pocket. He's very good at not, you know, putting any fat on his drop back, not going farther than he has to. Really good rotational mechanics, really good general accuracy. And I think he does have really good drive velocity, and he's fearless throwing over the middle. If a DB turns his back, he's taking advantage of that. He's capitalizing. He's taking that risk, and more often than not, he's able to, you know, kind of get the positive outcome. So JJ McCarthy, a lot of talent, there's a lot of projection as well, but I think the safe traits are there where you're willing to bank on that development.
So I am a big Drake May fan. I like Jaden Daniels too, but as things stand right now, I want the Commanders taking May at 2. Obviously you agree in having May as your QB1 in the 2024 draft. As you know, that is an uncommon take, having May as the QB1 over Caleb Williams.
Just by a hair. It's very slight, but it's essentially a tie. But Drake May, to me, I feel like there are a lot of good traits on his film that go overlooked sometimes because people look at the accuracy. It's not perfect, right? But I don't think anything is a liability by any stretch. I do think he's shown that he can control his mechanics, the place where only his receivers can get it, lead them away from contact over the middle of the field. I think those traits are very strong. But the biggest thing with me for him, he's a very good athlete. He's got an incredible arm and he knows how to utilize it. He's a very good processor over the middle of the field, intermediate and deep ranges, his ability to control the field. Again, you know, there were a few throws. I think his Georgia Tech game this year was immaculate, right? And that North Carolina offense wasn't great and May had some volatility as well. But I just think his ability to not only control the field with his eyes, but also control the pocket and the spacing with his pocket navigation ability, you know, his ability to slide away from pressure, keep himself clean while keeping his eyes up the field. I look at Caleb Williams, right? I think he's pretty clean in structure too. But Caleb Williams, one reason he's so popular is because he's so good at navigating through those chaotic situations with his creation ability. But sometimes he brings on that chaos unnecessarily by missing open receivers in the short range, right? So I think they're really close for me, but Drake May is a little bit better at controlling the situation, controlling the field, and capitalizing with his elite traits. And that gives him the edge for me.
There is such a wide variance of opinion on Drake May. There are people like you who really like him, And then there are people who are really down on him. What do you make of those who do not view May as highly as you do?
I think it's tuning in on the volatility of his game, which there is some volatility. I won't shy away from that. I do think mainly the mechanics and the accuracy. If you had to tune in on one thing, that's probably what it is. And then also, like any young QB, if you get in a high pressure situation, like the pressure is flushing you out to the flat, you'll force a throw that maybe you shouldn't. That shows up sometimes too, right? I think the biggest thing for him is a lot of the things that you see from young QBs, he's susceptible to, right? And that's okay, right? You want to project guys. You want to project their growth. And I think there are some slight minute mechanics inconsistencies. The biggest thing for me is his base width can be a little inconsistent when he's shuffling up. I wanted to kind of keep that rotational efficiency with that. And then his release can be a little winding on control at times, but I do think on rhythm throws, he's shown he can keep that release tight. So it's not a big concern for me. I think repetitions should help with that. And then those mechanical inefficiencies naturally stem to, you know, some imprecision on occasion, right? So those are the biggest things for me. And I can see people tuning in on that, but I also see people just looking at the stats, right? You know, oh, his completion percentage dropped. His TD to INT ratio dropped. Let's not engage with that, because surface level stats, they leave so many other things untested, unquestioned, and you really have to look at the tape. And the tape to me shows a 21-year-old quarterback who, yeah, needs to iron out some parts of his game, but is still at an incredibly high level for such a young QB at things like seeing the field, reading the field, identifying mismatches in the secondary, identifying leverage advantages that he can capitalize on with his arm talent, and then using his eyes. This is the big thing, using his eyes to control that DB, honing in on that, and then capitalizing with precision and velocity. I think his ability to do that, staying poised, multitasking, all really high-level QB things that make me look at the volatility and say, I can work with that. Because if I can work with that and improve that, he can be an all-pro player, right? So, you know, it's one thing with me projecting, right? And then at the same time, too, for such a young QB, he's out here managing protections, right? You know, he's out here calling before the line. He has so many things under his belt already at such a young age that I'm willing to see through the lumps to get to that promised land, right? You know, and there's no guarantee that you'll get there, right? But you get him with the right situation, the right supportive and cast. I really think the upside is one of the highest that we've seen in the last 5 years.
A big knock on Jaden Daniels is his lack of sack avoidance. His career pressure to sack rate for Pro Football Focus is a sky high 24.5. Now, his pressure to sack rate for his great 2023 season was better, 20.2. And there are some quarterbacks who have improved upon their pressure to sack rates from college to the NFL by multiple percentage points. So the Los Angeles Chargers, Justin Herbert comes to mind. The Philadelphia Eagles, Jalen Hurts comes to mind. And there is the reality that a lot of ultra-mobile quarterbacks like Daniels actually have high pressure to sack rates because those quarterbacks do so much scrambling. But where are you on the Jaden Daniels pressure to sack rate issue?
It's difficult because he has the ability to avoid it for sure. He's probably the most mobile quarterback in the class. And that's saying a lot because he's got Caleb Williams, right? So Jaden Daniels is electric. I mean, his lateral agility, his explosiveness, his speed is unmatched. I mean, and he's a lighter guy. So he's a featherweight. So he can do that. Like, he's very light on his feet, very nimble. But yeah, I do think there are times where he's a little careless, a little reckless, and, you know, will box himself in sometimes. It's not just about having that athleticism. It's knowing how to use it. And to be fair, I think especially when he has space, he's very good at that. I think when he has space, gets out with his speed and can elongate his strides, that's when he's able to generate those chunk plays. But sometimes pressure can force him to kind of panic and drop his eyes a little bit. And that's when you run into those issues, right? And there's reps that you'll see on tape where he's jumping into crowds, right? Where he's trying to finish forward when he doesn't really have the frame to do that. It's limiting, cutting down those instances and kind of improving the decision making in those scenarios that I think could improve that. And it's a dangerous thing because you look at that pressure to sack ratio, not a great hit rate for quarterbacks that are higher on that, right? You look at guys when you encounter pressure, and this goes back to the conversation we had with off-platform throwing ability, you have to be able to withstand adversity at the NFL level, right? You can be the most mobile quarterback in the world, but if you don't know how to react in those situations, that's not going to change the outcome. It's still going to be a sack or an interception or just a good play for the defense, right? And to be fair with Daniels, it's volatile, right? The swing is big. The high moments are very high. The low moments are very low. So I think if you can cut down on those low moments, you're in a good spot. But he does need to improve kind of his wherewithal, his awareness in those situations, I think, because he's shown he can throw with rhythm passes. He's shown he's a very good deep passer. He can operate the middle of the field. I think he's a little inconsistent there, especially for a guy who's going to turn 24 in December, but those tools are there. He's very poised in the pocket. Just cutting down those lapses in decision making, in situational awareness, that can help. But sometimes bad habits come back to bite guys when it is the heat of the moment. So it's a tough balance to strike, but hopefully Washington can, you know, induce the scheme and support to help him there.
Another big knock on Jaden Daniels is him being, like you said, a featherweight. And how that, in conjunction with a reckless running style, would seem to make him a significant injury risk. Although, to his credit, he in his collegiate career avoided major injury. But to what extent do you view Daniels as an injury risk?
Yeah, durability is one of those things, and you can get caught by surprise all the time at the NFL level, right? You know, it's pretty volatile. It's very much up to chance and luck, and unfortunately, right? You can't kind of anticipate it. But he doesn't have a lengthy injury history from the college level, so it's not something that gives me too much concern. But as you said, yes, the play style combined with the frame can lead to durability issues. So that's kind of how I frame it in my scouting report. Like, hey, this is something to be aware of, something to be cognizant of. It's not something we need to be worried about from a durability standpoint right now because he doesn't have that history, but it could lead to that down the road. And I think that's where, if you're a coach, if you're dead set on taking this guy, get him in your room first and then say, hey, we want you to try and win within the structure a little bit. You know, take care of yourself because you're our most important player, right? But that's the thing where I think as long as he hasn't showed those durability issues, the coaches can get him in a room and, you know, kind of hammer that point home where, hey, you're our most important player. Don't be diving into a crowd with four other defenders, right? Or lowering your shoulder in open space when you're going at full speed, right? We need you to preserve yourself. And I think that's one thing that he can improve, but I think it's something he will improve once he gets those coaching points.
Yeah, I mean, Jaden Daniels at times with his running looks like he has a death wish.
It's crazy. But I think it's one of those things. It hasn't been an issue from an injury standpoint. So just get ahead of it, get that in his mind. Like, hey, you know, be a little more controlled and we'll be good to go.
For sure. Much more with Ian Cummings in moments. The Commanders quarterback decision is tricky, but the decision on which law firm that you should trust is easy. Paulson and Nace. If you have a case, contact Paulson and Nace. Paulson and Nace is a Washington, D.C.-based family law firm that handles medical malpractice, personal injury, birth injury, legal malpractice, and consumer protection cases, offering aggressive advocacy for victims in Washington, D.C. and West Virginia. Chris Nace, Matt Nace, and the rest of the team do excellent work. If you feel that you've been wronged, if you think that you've been wronged but aren't sure, call Paulson and Nace and schedule a no-obligation appointment. Call 202-902-7611. That's 202-902-7611. And when you call, tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. If you have a case, contact Paulson and Nace. Paulson and Nace has recovered millions of dollars for the sick and injured. Consider this. Paulson and Nace has taken on Big Pharma and won. Two verdicts versus Merrill Dow totaling $132 million. Also, Paulson and Nace took on the U.S. government and won. Bradley versus the United States of America. Paulson and Nace won a case for which the United States government had to pay nearly $1.8 million. If you have a case, contact Paulson and Nace. Call 202-902-7611. 202-902-7611. When you call, tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. You could also visit paulsonandnace.com. Just don't forget to tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. Paulson and Nace, when tragedy happens, let the family of Paulson and Nace take care of your family. We're talking with NFL draft analyst Ian Cummings of Pro Football Network. Therefore, the Commanders has not been that much discussion about the quarterbacks in the 2024 draft beyond Caleb Williams, Drake May, Jaden Daniels, and Michigan's J.J. McCarthy. But I do think that it's worth at least hitting on some of the other quarterbacks. And two guys who come up are Washington's Michael Penix Jr. and Oregon's Bo Nix. You wrote about this in a ProFootballNetwork.com piece that came out on March 19th. Headline, quote, "Who is the fifth best QB in the 2024 NFL draft? Bo Nix versus Michael Penix Jr. continue their friendly rivalry," end quote. Before we get into who is better, is there a compelling argument for Penix or Nix to be, say, a top 15 pick in the 2024 draft? Or is that overstating what those guys are?
On my board, it's overstating it a little bit, right? And that's the thing, you know, how do you balance the valuation over what you think that can be? Because if you can get Bo Nix into a good supporting cast, or if you can get Penix into a really good situation, there's a chance they pay off the dividends enough where they would have been worth it, right? So hindsight is always 20/20. We never know for sure. Looking at them as prospects, it is a little rich for me, but you know, for instance, Bo Nix, Denver has been a big, it's been a popular mock draft destination for him because of that Sean Payton offense, working the middle of the field, being a distributor in the short and intermediate ranges. That's one of Nix's strengths, right? Michael Penix Jr. If the Vikings wanted to pass on a QB, we know they're going to trade up for one, but just for hypothetical purposes, let's say they pass on one, they pick someone else at 11, and at 23 overall, you got a chance to pick Penix. The way that he can fit in that Kevin O'Connell scheme with his ability to win from the pocket with that drive velocity, that would be an excellent fit too. So team fits play a big role in the outcomes and how they progress. But on my board, it's a little rich for them, the top 15.
Are Michael Penix Jr. and Bo Nix worthy of first round picks?
I think they're worthy of being considered in round one. My grading scale makes it so that there's some breathing room, right? You know, it's not a succinct, yes, he is worth it. No, he's not. Because again, it depends on the situation. If you insert a guy, and especially the team's picking 21st or 32nd, right? Usually either they have a strong situation, or if you're Washington and you want to trade back in, you've already used that first rounder on a good player too. So, you know, usually the teams picking in the back end have the supporting cast to properly acclimate a quarterback like that. So again, it plays into that. I do think they're worth consideration. I think both guys are, I think, for varying reasons.
It is very hard to get beyond the injury history of Michael Penix Jr. He, in each of his four seasons at Indiana, 2018 through 2021, suffered a season-ending injury. He tore his right ACL twice, October 2018 and November 2020. Also, November 2019, a season-ending right shoulder injury, and October 2021, a season-ending left shoulder injury. How much is the Penix injury history a worry for you?
It was a decent worry heading into the NFL Combine, but then we heard reports that he had passed his medical evaluation. So that was the biggest checkpoint for me, because looking at his tape, you know, I think as long as he can stay healthy, I do think there's a path to him being a quality NFL starting quarterback. I think he's got the drive velocity. I think he's a really competitive player. That touchdown run for Indiana against Penn State a few years ago is the highlight, but you're always seeing this guy gutting through injuries, leading his team on comeback runs. He's just a tough guy, and he's a leader, and he knows how to lead his team and rally his teammates. So I think that's going to win guys over. For me, the biggest thing was the medical history, but you know, passing that check at the combine was, I think, the biggest thing, because I think you can talk about durability mid-season, but what teams are looking for at the combine is those long-term longevity issues, right? You know, maybe arthritic things where it's gonna, you know, kind of build up and maybe prevent him to play at 100% down the road. So the fact that he passed that evaluation was a big green flag, a big step in the right direction for me, because that was the biggest roadblock for him.
What is Michael Penix Jr.'s biggest strength?
Definitely his drive velocity. The dude's got a crazy arm, and it's funny because his mechanics are primarily arm dominant. He doesn't have a ton of hip rotation. You know, I think there's still ways that he can better activate his lower body, but he can still put it to his man 40 yards downfield on a laser past defensive backs. I think, you know, if we're talking about pure arm strength, I think you're looking at Penix right at the top of the class with guys like May, Joe Milton, Caleb Williams. I think he's in that very top group with arm strength and his toughness too. I mean, he can stand in the pocket. He's very poised. We saw him run that 40 yard dash as fast as he did, which, to be fair, he's a little high cut, he's a little stiff in the hips, so that limits his creation ability. But he's so good at dicing up defenses from within the pocket because he's a good processor, he's got good field vision, but most importantly, he has the arm to get the ball from point A to point B at 80 miles an hour. I think that's probably one of his biggest strengths, but it all goes hand in hand with him.
Beyond the injury concern, what is the biggest concern with Michael Penix Jr.?
The biggest concern, I would say, creationary limitations. I think he's a really good straight line athlete, but he is very stiff in the hips, and that shows up a little bit. Like, you look at Drake May, who's around 6'4", 230, so prototypical size, both of them. But Drake May, to me, is a lot more fluid, agile, really good off platform, off script. You don't see that quite as much with Penix. I think there are times if he is forced off script, his situational precision can get really inconsistent. I think those are times where he'll try and force the ball into tight windows too, have a little arm arrogance, and May has that too. But I think with Penix, you're a little more confined with what you can do with him. I think within the pocket, he's very good, and he is very good in a straight line if he's running, but there isn't that short area freedom that you would want from other guys. So I think that limits his projection a little bit. And then at the same time, too, there are some mechanical inconsistencies, but I think the biggest thing, the stiffness, the creation limitations.
Bo Nix, there certainly are things to like with him. Some of his stats put him right up there with the perceived top quarterbacks in the 2024 draft. What do you like the most about Nix?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it, man. I think he broke the record for qualifying quarterbacks for completion percentage in a season. I think 77.4%. So he was incredibly efficient at Oregon. I think that's just as much a pro as it is a con because we didn't get to see him go through a lot of full field NFL style reads, right? You know, a lot of it was schemed for him, but he's very good as that distributor, that game manager, that offensive conductor, right? You know, he's very good off platform on design rollouts, but he can also take short drops. He's very accurate over the short range. I think he's got that creation ability too. You know, with him, it's just he's so smooth, he's so controlled, and that's such a big dichotomy from when he started at Auburn, because you could see the talent, right? You could see the athleticism and the escapability, right? The arm talent off platform. But at Oregon, he really channeled it, and I think gained maturity with that, and I think he learned how to properly control his traits, and what resulted was incredible efficiency at the Oregon offense. So I think with him, the biggest thing is staying controlled with those high level creation tools and using that to kind of channel the offense and let it flow through him.
And your biggest worry with Bo Nix?
The drive velocity isn't there with him like it is for other guys. I do think he has enough arm elasticity to throw off platform and maintain velocity off platform, but his arm just isn't quite as strong as some of these other early round quarterbacks. And combine that with the inconsistency with multi-layered reads at the intermediate and deep ranges, that concerns me a little bit. It's not a question of what his floor is. I think if you put him in a solid offensive structure, he can be a really good conductor for your offense. And he is athletic. He can actually create and provide some running ability too. It's just, what is his ultimate ceiling as a passer? That's kind of the question, because the arm is above average. It's not elite. And then also you don't have a ton of experience with full field reads. So that's probably the biggest thing.
Getting to what you wrote, who do you like better, Michael Penix Jr. or Bo Nix?
I've been flip-flopping the entire cycle, man. They're really close for me. I think I'm leaning Penix now. I think the medical check was a big plus for me. And I think looking at, you know, now that he's proven he can stay healthy, right? You know, he's got a very good arm. I think he's a better NFL level processor. I think his ability to pick out those windows outside the numbers and the intermediate and deep ranges, I think he's really good at that. I think he's a little bit more poised than Nix. There are times when Nix has a little bit too much fat on his dropbacks. He'll try and create and kind of box himself in. So I think Penix is a guy. You look at the pocket poise, you look at the ability to stay on schedule, hit tight windows, the processing. To me, that puts him a little bit higher than Nix as a translatable starting quarterback. But they're very close for me, because with the trade-off, right, with the arm strength you get from Penix, you have the creation ability and the athleticism with Nix and the off-platform ability. So they both have their pros and cons. For me right now, Penix has a slight edge.
You, in this conversation, have brought up how quarterbacks are in terms of off-platform throws. I think that most people listening know what an off-platform throw is, but how would you explain why off-platform throws have become important in evaluating quarterbacks?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's two things, because there are opportunities where you're schemed off platform, like boot actions, rollouts, where part of the offensive play structure is that you have to be throwing on the run, right? You know, so some situations call for that, but also, you know, whether you have a 3-step drop or a 5-step drop or a 7-step drop, very few plays go according to plan at the NFL level. And a lot of times pressure is going to force you off your spot. Ideally, you know, mechanically sound quarterbacks, they draw power from their base, right? You get that back foot behind you. You rotate through. If you're in phase, that's what you're doing, right? But so often, right, pressure will force you off your spot, and you're forced to make a play on the run, off platform, on the move, and you have to still generate that torque, keep your shoulders level. So I think it's a lot tougher to do that. And you can look at guys like Patrick Mahomes. Obviously, he's the kind of the standard bearer for it, but it's becoming more a bigger thing for even the rising quarterbacks in the league, like Jordan Love from the Green Bay Packers, right? You know, just being able to throw while your base isn't set, being able to maintain that congruence in, you know, ill-advised situations. So I think looking at that in kind of in a nutshell, it's an ability to withstand adversity, if I had to put it, you know, big broad scale, but being able to do that, you know, we see those less mobile quarterbacks, those less flexible quarterbacks, they aren't able to do that quite as much. And it does limit their upside in those adverse situations.
Great stuff. NFL draft analyst Ian Cummings of Pro Football Network. Ian, thank you and have a great weekend.
Yes, sir. Thank you as well.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, things had been going so well for the Capitals in their push for the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Caps had been 13-5-1 over their last 19 games, but the Caps now are 0-3-1 over their last four games. Thursday night, a 4-1 loss to the Pittsburgh Penguins at Capital One Arena. This was a big game for the Caps, but they got ripped. And also on Thursday night was the New York Islanders winning at the Columbus Blue Jackets 4-2. So the Caps for this NHL regular season now are 36-29-10, still have 82 points, now are 1 point behind the Islanders for the Eastern Conference's second and final wildcard spot, and now are in fifth place in the 8-team Metropolitan Division, while being just 1 point ahead of the Penguins, who are sixth in the Metro. The top three teams in each division make the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Caps are losing ground, and they have just 7 games left in this regular season. There's also this: the Caps for this regular season continue to have the third worst goal differential in the Eastern Conference. I've talked about this a bunch. That Caps goal differential for this regular season is at minus 38. The Caps are a team that has overachieved big time in terms of record versus goal differential. A big reason for this 4-1 Caps loss to the Penguins on Thursday night was goaltending. Charlie Lindgren was the Caps starting goaltender for the 28th time in 36 games, but he stopped just 20 of the 23 shots on goal that he faced, and all three of the goals that Lindgren allowed came on low-danger shots on goal per natural stat trick, which had him as stopping all 6 of the high-danger shots on goal that he faced, all 2 of the medium-danger shots on goal that he faced, but just 12 of the 15 low-danger shots on goal that he faced. Not good. The Caps lost this game despite dominating the puck possession battle. They had 31 shots on goal to the Penguins 24, and per natural stat trick had 58 5-on-5 shot attempts to the Penguins 32. The difference in the game was goaltending. The Caps were good on special teams, 2-for-2 on the penalty kill and 1-for-4 on the power play, as a top line left wing Alex Ovechkin scored a power play goal, 6:02 into the third period, for his team leading 27th goal of this regular season. Ovi had a really good game. He had the power play goal, a game high tying 8 shots on goal, a game high 15 total shot attempts, and 6 hits, as the Caps had a whopping 54 hits to the Penguins 39. This was a really physical game, and Ovechkin was tied for number 1 on the Caps in 5-on-5 shot attempt percentage for the game per natural stat trick at 80. The Caps with Ovechkin on the ice in 5-on-5 situations in the game had 28 shot attempts versus allowing just 7 shot attempts. Also, the Caps lost this game despite Tom Wilson being back. He returned from his 6-game suspension. The NHL on March 22nd announced that Wilson had been suspended for 6 games without pay for high-sticking Toronto Maple Leafs forward Noah Gregor in the third period of the Caps' 7-3 loss to the Maple Leafs at Capital One Arena on March 20th. Wilson on Thursday night was a top line, Tom. He served as the Caps' top line right wing. He played well. 3 shots on goal, 7 hits, and was number 3 on the Caps' 5-on-5 shot attempt percentage for the game per natural stat trick at 77.42. The Caps with Wilson on the ice in 5-on-5 situations in the game had 24 shot attempts versus allowing just 7 shot attempts. So Wilson did commit a second period slashing minor, and the Caps did lose. I mean, from an analytics perspective, the Caps did so many things well in this game, and yet the Caps lost decisively 4-1. This was Caps head coach Spencer Carberry during his post-game press conference on Thursday night on if he's concerned about his team with it now 0-3-1 over its last 4 games.
No, because we know where we are. I mean, this isn't any different for us. Tomorrow night, massive game against a really good hockey team where, you know, points and where we stand are hanging in the balance. So I don't think what's gone on over the last 2-3 games, yeah, is a scoring an issue for sure. Do we got to find ways to score and get to the interior and get creative and do some things from a coaching, and our players need to do a better job of that too. Power play for sure. But I don't think it changes or because what's gone on the last three or four games, it's like, oh no, we can't accomplish a win tomorrow night, because that's what our focus has been for the last 2 months, is just figure out a way to beat Carolina.
And next up for the Caps are two games this weekend. The Caps are at the Carolina Hurricanes Friday night at 7. The Hurricanes are second in the Metropolitan Division, and the Caps are home to the Ottawa Senators Sunday evening at 6. Well, one of the best aspects of the Nationals 2023 season was that it was a step forward season for starting pitcher Josiah Gray. Gray, in the 2023 regular season, over 30 starts, totaled 159 innings and registered an ERA of 391, an ERA plus of 110, and a wins above replacement per Baseball Reference of 3.1. Now, he also had a whip of 1.459. That is quite high. And he, in August and September of last season, had a stretch of being bad in 5 of 6 starts. He was not perfect, okay? But he ended his 2023 season with 3 consecutive decent slash good starts. He was the Nats' lone 2023 All-Star. But Gray, over 2 starts in this 2024 regular season, is that doing well? Now, 2 Thursdays ago, March 28th, he allowed 7 runs in 4 innings in the Nats' 8-2 opening day loss at the Cincinnati Reds. And now we have what happened on this most recent Thursday, Gray officially allowing 6 runs in 4 1/3 innings in the Nats' 7-4 loss to the Pittsburgh Pirates at Nationals Park on Thursday, in a game for which the start was delayed for 1 hour and 10 minutes due to rain. The Nats lose the series 2-1. The Nats in their 2024 regular season now are just 2-4. So Gray officially allowed 6 runs in 4 1/3 innings. He gave up 7 hits, which were comprised of 2 doubles and 5 singles. He issued 3 walks. 3 walks in just 4 1/3 innings is not good. He recorded just 3 strikeouts. He over his mere 4 1/3 innings threw 96 pitches. That is a sky-high pitch count for 4 1/3 innings, 58 strikes versus 38 balls. Gray, in a disastrous top of the first, allowed 4 runs, did so on a double, 2 singles, and 2 walks. He, in the top of the second, allowed a run on a double and a single. And he, in the top of the fifth, was charged with a run off issuing a 1-out walk to the final batter he faced, Jack Suwinski. Josiah Gray struggled in the Nats' 2024 exhibition season. 5 starts, 16 1/3 innings, ERA a 6.61, whip of 196. But that was the exhibition season. Spring training baseball can be very misleading, but Gray so far in this regular season, not doing well. 2 starts, ERA of 14.04. This was Nats manager Davey Martinez during his post-game press conference on Thursday night on Josiah Gray.
Yeah, he's missing, his direction is kind of a little off, but, the first inning, he got ahead of the first 3 batters and just couldn't put them away, and they hit some pretty good pitches. Nothing really hard, but that's kind of how it all starts, so... But then, he gave up another run, and then he's kind of settled down a little bit. But it's the 0-2s to the 3-2s. If he wants to pitch deep in the games, we got to get him to finish, 3 or 4 pitches or less. That's the key. So, the only ball that was hit hard off him was Michael Taylor. The double after that, everything was soft. So he's got to understand. He's got to get the ball in the strike zone, which he did, and finish. Don't drag out the at bats. He's going to be okay. I really believe he's going to be okay. Like I said, he came out. He stuck through it and gave us as much as he can. But the pitch count got up there, and I didn't want to push him to 100 pitches.
Yeah, you heard Davey Martinez reference something that has plagued Josiah Gray, mechanics that get out of whack and lead to him having trouble putting batters away. The Nats' offense in this 7-4 loss to the Pirates on Thursday was very mixed. The Nats did work 4 walks and did go 3-for-8 with runners in scoring position, but the Nats totaled just 8 hits, 6 of which were singles, and the Nats scored just 4 runs, including just 2 runs over the first 7 innings. The Nats scored a run in the bottom of the second, a run in the bottom of the fifth, and 2 runs in the bottom of the eighth. The Nats, so far this regular season, are scoring way too little in the early portions of games. Another rough game For Lane Thomas, he on Thursday as an at starting right fielder and number two batter went 0-for-4 with a walk. Lane Thomas over six games in this regular season is a 2-for-24 with three walks, and both of his hits have been singles. The biggest offensive bright spot for the Nats on Thursday, CJ Abrams. He is the Nats starting shortstop and number one batter, went 2-for-5 with a solo homer and a single. Abrams in the Nats one run fifth had a two out first pitch solo homer to right center field to cut the Nats deficit to 7-2. The homer went a projected 415 feet per Statcast. And Abrams in the bottom of the seventh had a two out opposite field single to left field on an 0-2 pitch, and a really nice piece of hitting by Abrams. He is off to a terrific start. Six games in this regular season, OPS of 1,074. Some other offensive bright spots for the Nats on Thursday. Jesse Winker had another nice game. He was back off having left the Nats 8-4 loss to the Pirates on Monday after just one inning due to being sick. Winker on Thursday as the Nats starting left fielder and number six batter went 1-for-3 with an RBI single and a walk. And each plate appearance was impressive. Winker in the Nats one run second had a went out RBI single through the right side of the infield to cut the Nats deficit to 5-1 despite having been down in the count at 1.02, and Winker in the Nats two-run eighth drew a two-out walk despite having been down in that count at 1.12. Joey Gallo had a second consecutive good game. Gallo in the Nats 5-3 win over the Pirates on Wednesday evening as the Nats starting first baseman and number four batter went 3-for-4 with a solo homer, a double, and a single. And Gallo on Thursday as the Nats starting first baseman and number four batter went 1-for-3 with a double and a walk. He and the Nats one run second had a leadoff first pitch double to right field, and he and the Nats a two run eighth drew a one-out walk. And Trey Lipscomb and Luis Garcia Jr. had key hits in the Nats' two-run eighth. The Lipscomb in that two-run eighth had a two-out opposite field RBI single through the right side of the infield to cut the Nats' deficit to 7-3. He on Thursday, as the Nats' starting third baseman and number seven batter, went 1-for-4 with that RBI single. And Luis Garcia Jr. in the Nats' two-run eighth had a pinch two-out RBI infield single on a grounder off Pirates' second baseman Jared Triolo to cut the Nats' deficit to 7-4. The Nats on Thursday afternoon did announce that they had placed center fielder Victor Robles on the 10-day injured list with a left hamstring strain that he suffered in that 5-3 win over the Pirates on Wednesday evening. No surprise that Robles lands on that 10-day IL. The corresponding roster move was the Nats recalling outfielder Jacob Young from AAA Rochester. Young on Thursday was the Nats starting center fielder and number 9 batter. He went 0-for-4 with a strikeout. The Nats bullpen in this 7-4 loss to the Pirates on Thursday was decent. Four Nats relievers officially combined to allow one run in 4 2/3 innings. Derek Law officially allowed a run in 1 2/3 innings. He came into the game in the top of the fifth with a runner on first, one out, and the Nats trailing 5-1. And he, to the first batter he faced, gave up a two-run homer by Connor Joe to left field for a 7-1 Pirates lead. Matt Barnes tossed a perfect top of the seventh. Tanner Rainey tossed a scoreless top of the eighth, despite giving up an infield single and another single and issuing a wild pitch and an intentional walk. So Rainey still trying to work his way back into form off having pitched in just one game last regular season at the major league level, off having undergone Tommy John surgery in August 2022. And Dylan Floro tossed a scoreless top of the ninth. Now, he issued back-to-back one-out walks, but he then generated back-to-back called strikeouts. Next up for the Nats, a three-game series against the Philadelphia Phillies at Nationals Park this weekend. Game one, Friday evening at 6:45. Patrick Corbin will be the Nats starting pitcher. Game two, Saturday afternoon at 4:05. Jake Irvin will be the Nats starting pitcher. And game three, Sunday afternoon at 1:05. Mackenzie Gore will be the Nats starting pitcher. And that will do it for you and me for now. Keep the feedback coming. You can hit me up on X at Al Galdi. You can email me the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. Monday show, episode 800. Yes, episode 800. It will have a lot for you on the Commanders. Also on Monday show, I'll talk Capitals, Nationals, Orioles, and Wizards. So the Caps have two games this weekend at the Carolina Hurricanes Friday night at 7 and home to the Ottawa Senators Sunday evening at 6. The Nats have a 3-game series against the Philadelphia Phillies at Nationals Park this weekend. The O's have a 3-game series at the Pittsburgh Pirates this weekend. And the Wizards have 2 games this weekend, home to the Portland Trail Blazers Friday night at 7 and at the Toronto Raptors Sunday evening at 6. Have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you on Monday.
I know we're not supposed to spoil picks. We'll see how the Commanders decide to move forward with the number 2 overall selection, but a little over a few weeks out, to me, I think the signs continue to point to Jaden Daniels being the 2nd overall pick at number 2.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.